Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing some important news items from that week. On Wednesday, June 14th, Joe was joined by immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, corporate attorney with Phillips Lytle LLP, Rich Honan, and executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
The former president of the United States was arraigned yesterday, charged in a classified documents case. And things went pretty much according to plan. It was a little bit of a circus atmosphere in the city of Miami, but for the most part, it went as was expected. Donald Trump lashed out at former federal prosecutors and portrayed himself as a victim of political persecution hours after pleading not guilty in a Miami court to charges that he illegally retained and shared classified national security documents after leaving the White House. Quote, "Today we witness the most evil and heinous abuse of power in the history of our country," Trump said Tuesday night at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, surrounded by supporters and a crush of reporters, capping an extraordinary day in which the former president and 2024 GOP frontrunner sought to capitalize on the attention in the case. "This day will go down in infamy," Trump said. He made a number of claims, including that he had the right to take the documents with him to his Mar-a-Lago resort in Palm Beach, Florida, though he said they were in boxes of personal items, including news clips and photographs, that he didn't have a chance to go through them all. Bob Griffin?
Yeah, so, you know, it's more of the Trump playbook, right? The charges are absurd. I'm being persecuted. Then I have the right to do it. Then, yeah, I did it, but it's no big deal. I mean, it's the same rollout that we've seen time and time again. You know, for folks that may not have been following the story, you know, basically he's being charged with having documents that he shouldn't have had and then sharing them with other people and directing staff to hide them. You know, one of the questions that I would love somebody to ask him is that if he felt like he really had the right to these documents, why did he feel like he had to keep hiding them? You know, so there's a lot of those cover-ups or sort of questionable activities. A couple of points that I'd like to toss on the table, and I'd be interested in sort of understanding a little bit more from our attorney friends on the panel. The magistrate made a point in yesterday's proceeding, reminding Trump's legal team that they cannot now pull out of the case even if they're not paid. I was just wondering, is that normal, or is that addressing Trump's typical or sort of pattern of not paying his attorneys or workers?
Rich or Sienna, go ahead. I heard.
Well, once you file as entry into your appearance as an attorney in court, you know, I'm in criminal court and federal court, that you have to get the permission of the judge to leave. So what they're saying is you can't submit a motion to me withdraw based on non-payment. I mean, that's just not a good basis to withdraw as counsel. You need more than that.
So it's stock language then.
Yeah. I will say it is stock. When they really make a big deal out of it is when someone else has already withdrawn.
Exactly.
I thought some people withdrew. I thought he had some.
He was having issues with Pro Hoc Vitae.
Yeah.
Getting local counsel. And local counsel was like pulling out, trying to get counsel in. He was having issues with that.
Right. So judges will, I agree. And in my experience, especially when you're coming into a case where someone else has already gotten out, or you're coming in where, especially if the other attorney is getting out because they were not paid, the judge will say, okay, but understand, I'm not putting up with this again. Once you are in, you are in. And don't come to me and be all surprised when he doesn't pay you or when he turns on you, you know, or something like that. So it makes a lot of sense in this case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also important to note that this judge was just the magistrate. He duty judge for the day, right? Right. Judge Cannon is the judge overseeing. She's the one that signed the orders on Pro Hoc Vice for the counsel. So she's really the one that's going to be making those final decisions on motions to withdraw.
And there's two cases I just want to toss on the table so we could talk more about. One, you know, Robert Burkham was sentenced to 3 years in prison for keeping classified documents. That sounded very similar to that. That was done in April. In June. And then in April, Special Forces Officer Jeremy Brown was sentenced to 7 years for exactly the same case. So I'll be really interested to see how this whole thing rolls out. And I could tell you, Joe, given my past, if I had a single document, I'd be facing jail time.
And with and you've had security clearance.
I have had security clearances.
And had access to classified information.
Yes.
So that's where that comes from.
And I would note in those cases, I believe they cooperated in that case. They gave everything back. It was, you know, so I think there's a distinction being made.
But there. They still got three years.
Exactly.
I mean, that so.
And one of them was in Florida.
Yes. That was the June 1st case,
yes,
correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Rich?
Look, I'll skip the right-wing talking points of, you know, Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. No, let's just assume they've all been said. You know, it's funny. I agree with everything that's been said. Remember when Trump made first of all, he's just so nuanced, isn't he? He's just he's so subtle. But you know, when he made that statement early on, he's like, I'm so popular, I could go out and shoot somebody. And I think, you know, it's almost like he's bent on doing that. I think that he's trying to see how many laws he can be alleged to have broken. It gets quickly to you know, the political implications. You know, what's going to happen? I mean, the case is the case. You know, if you know, the allegations are pretty clear. You know, and he's already, I think, gone out of his way to undercut some of his defenses. I think the Wall Street Journal made that point in an editorial today. And so the only question of any interest is, you know, do his people still hang on? Do the Trump supporters in a primary still hang on, you know, to the death?
They have to, because he has two options. Either he pleads, or you push this trial as far as you can until you get elected. He has two options, really, yeah, because the case, but he's going to be convicted on one of those, not 37, because not all of them are his, but one of those counts, right? One of them. And let's, God forbid, that his not, I think it's pronounced not, right?
Yeah.
With Walter Nott, if he turns on him, if he flips, oh my gosh. No, he either pleads or he pushes it with the help of Judge Cannon until it gets too close to election to even have it in good faith. And then once he becomes elected, then he doesn't have to deal with it. I think those are his two primary options, because this is one case where it is, the witnesses are strong. You're dealing with attorneys testifying. You have documents, you have recordings, you have video. I mean, this is like a bad episode of Law and Order that ends really really soon. They solve the case, and most of the episode is the trial. You know those episodes where they solve it really quickly? That is what we're dealing with here. And so I think, like, either
TikTok version of
the TikTok version of Law and Order. So I think he should take a plea deal. I hope that's what his counsel is talking to him about, is taking a plea deal, trying to get him as little or no jail time as possible, and pleading to a couple of the charges and moving on. But I don't think it's going to happen.
I think it's telling that DeSantis has already come out and said, if I get elected, I promise I'll pardon Donald Trump, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think it says a lot about anyone's faith in him coming out clean on this.
I wouldn't be shocked if he declines to waive his speedy trial and actually pushes it along. That would not shock
really?
Me. Yeah.
Why would...
Just
well, for the circus.
Yeah, I mean, first, I don't know that it gets, you know, speedy is, you know,
relative.
Yeah, it is. I mean, right, because at some point there's going to be some kind of interlocutory, some kind of appeal that takes place on some arcane piece of evidence or privilege. I mean, the privilege issues are probably pretty chunky, you know, and I'm just saying, you know, that there's a lot there. So
yeah,
I think he in public, I don't disagree with you from a legal standpoint. But from a from electoral standpoint,
even with Georgia sitting out there, though,
yeah, absolutely, it wouldn't shock me, because this seems to be his game plan. You know, everybody's, you know, I spoke the truth, and now everybody's against me. That's, you know, I'm saying, I think that's the game plan. It would not shock me if he said, I want to go to trial right now, you know, and see how far they push it. I'm not saying it's a good idea, but I don't know that it's a bad idea.
It depends. It depends on the jury pool that they get, but you know, it's going to be, you're going to go through voir dire, and they're going to, both sides are going to have the opportunity to choose the jury. And so I think based on the evidence, I think it gets there to that beyond a reasonable doubt. Just reading the indictment, it was just so telling. I mean, even if they get one of the people who he talked to about the documents, I'm sorry, to testify, I mean, that in and of itself is another count, right? So you have to think all of these different counts must go up.
You expected perhaps a bigger crowd.
Yeah, I did. I thought that it would be a little more organized and that they would try to show some numbers in support. That seems to be part of the energy that Donald Trump thrives on, that idea of being absolutely beloved. Now, let's be kind. It was ridiculously hot and muggy. It was Miami. The other observation was one that I heard, and I believe it was on CNN, so I can't remember which commentator made it, but how difficult it is to organize a mass event, and what that says about the January 6th insurrection and the planning that went into it. But I expected to see more than the crowd, and I expected to see a little bit more hardcore than sort of the circus Trump. Tears that were there.
So who benefits on the Republican primary side, if anybody? Does Trump benefit?
From his charges?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think the charges are a little bit too heady for many people to really understand what they mean. It's like talking about taxes. And so, there's only so far what about Hillary and what about Biden gets you. And after that, people are a little bit unsure of what it means other than the Espionage Act, right?
Yeah. But there are a bunch of, the rest of the field's a bunch of sucker fish that are hoping the shark dies, right? I mean, that's the only thing. I mean, that's the only thing that's the only thing that they got going for them.
Eloquent.
But yeah, so I mean, I think it's his to lose, that he's got a base that no matter what he does, they're going to apologize for his vile behavior, and it's enough to lock in the nomination. Now the question is, how badly does it turn off the rest of the country? And you know, I think that's the million-dollar question.
I don't know, because you're starting to see people turn away from Trump, and I'm looking to see who they're looking towards. You saw Paul Ryan speaking out. You saw the lovely Bill Barr speaking out. All of a sudden, he has an opinion. And so I think that what you're going to see is that we're kind of watching to see where this lands. We all thought a few months ago there's going to be DeSantis.
Right.
But I don't think he has enough going on in his backyard. And he's just almost as polarizing as Trump now. He carries some of that same baggage. So I don't know if it's going to be him. Nikki Haley, maybe. I'm not sure. She might benefit. Pence will not. I will tell you, Pence will probably not.
I mean, the one who seems to be, they're all a distant second to Trump in the polls, but the one who seems to be moving the needle more than anybody else is Chris Christie. I just don't know how long that'll last.
Yeah, that's
I think
that's a stunt. That's in the stunt category.
It'll come out. The show's fun. And then it'll grow old and it'll move on.
I thought you were going to say South Carolina.
Asa Hutchinson?
No, Tim Scott.
Oh, Tim Scott.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say that. But
I don't. In the poll numbers, I haven't seen those.
Oh, no. Yeah.
I haven't seen that. The momentum of a Tim Scott.
Well, the thing you hear, and again, I don't know if this is right-wing talking points or not, but you do, the one, actually I've heard this on both sides, is at the same point in the Obama-Hillary cycle, you know, Hillary was a bazillion points ahead, you know, at the same point in the Trump, Cruz, whoever were the big players early
Jeb,
on.
Jeb Bush?
Yeah, right, you know, they were a bazillion points ahead, you know. So the point being that things could change. I agree with you, though. I personally would have thought that DeSantis would have had a much stronger, really across the board, much stronger showing. You know, I thought he really came sputtering out And right? Is that yeah. is that the
well,
word?
Well, I mean, so let's talk about that for a second, because we haven't quietly tweeting. We've talked around this, but I think directly is really interesting because it seemed as if once he announced, then nothing went right. But when you look at what led up to it, these were actions that he thought were going to put him in the best place possible, and perhaps to even eclipse Trump as the front runner. But they were such extreme actions that it didn't work out that way.
Right, and he's been bubble wrapped in Florida. I mean, if you think about it, they control the narrative. He controls who's in his press conferences. He gets to stomp his feet and act like a little dictator, and it hasn't played well. And not only that, I've said it before, Joe, I'll say it again. He's got the personality of a dust bunny. Okay. And when you look at Trump, okay, whether you like the guy or not, he pulls a scary level of loyalty, some of which I still don't understand. But he is charismatic to a fault, and that's where I think the rest of the field gets left behind.
Yeah, I think I didn't know a lot about DeSantis. I mean, as the right wing person here, I really liked his policy, a lot of his policies, not all of them, in Florida. I was kind of waiting to see, all right, let's see how he transfers to the national stage. And even before this, you know, he took this weird view on Ukraine. He took a hit at Gavin Newsom. And I really get the feeling that either he has bad judgment or he's listening to people who are wrong, which is still bad judgment, right? You know, and he doesn't yet have the internal kind of security to override them. You know, Boring could be a great selling point for him. You know, he could say, "Yes, I'm boring. Okay, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to say that. I'm boring, but I get things done." You know, and he could sell that. You know, but he's just really he's sputtering. We'll see if he gets himself together. If not, I think somebody's going to jump in.
I don't think you can sell boring until after primaries, though. You need to have enough excitement to get people to show up in a primary race.
Yeah, that might be true. Yeah, these days, that might be true just because of the fringe that votes, you know, in the primaries. But I don't know. I'm trying to think of
Didn't
some
Biden
examples.
Didn't Biden get through on boring? Boring? I think Biden got through our primaries on boring.
Yeah. Right up to South Carolina. He yeah. did.
But what Biden had, but what the Republicans, what the Democrats had that Biden, that what the Republicans don't have is the person who after the first three or four primaries is going to call up, you know, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar and say, guess what? You're done. Okay, we got a job for you. We got a role for you, but you're out. It's Joe Biden. That's it. You know, they don't have Obama to do that. There's nobody in the Republican Party who's going to do that.
Trump.
Not him. I don't know who picks up that phone and says, "All right, you know, everybody's had a shot, but now you know it's a week before Super Tuesday, or it's a day after Super Tuesday, and now it's time for us to close ranks." I don't know that I see that happening. That's why Biden was able to sell boring and non-present. You know what I mean? Because everybody fell very well in line. They were very well organized on that. I don't see anybody in the Republican Party doing that.
I mean,
that.
This is basically what you've said, I think. But it was a matter of stability. We had been through, like, we were the snow globe, and it was just like a rambunctious 18-month-old was just shaking it and shaking it and shaking it for 4 years. And then the snow globe got sick, and then somebody said, let's stop shaking the snow globe.
It's so funny that you say the 18-month-old, because when we on the right talk about another Trump presidency, what everybody says is, besides the fact that I'd want to vote for him again, I can't take the screaming 2-year-old in the plane for the next 6 hours,
right.
Which is not Trump. It's you guys. Okay, that's the screaming 2-year-old.
The woke snowflakes.
The everybody else, basically. You know, and one, I don't feel strongly enough about Trump to vote for him, and I sure don't feel strongly enough to vote for him and then put up with all that crap for the next 4 years. But it's funny, but same analogy, though.
But the schism, I mean, let's get back to the schism in the Republican Party, because we see it not just with the presidential contenders. We're seeing it with Congress. So if you start to think about what's going on in the House right now, where you basically have 11 lunatics that are political terrorists that are holding the country hostage. And, you know, I'm really intrigued by what I'm starting to see is with the sort of the more moderates in the GOP in the caucus pushing back, saying, listen, this isn't, you know, we're not going to let you continue to wag the dog. So I think I don't think we're done yet on this intercedent food fight in the Republican Party. And I would also note for Democrats that are listening, don't get too smug, because you have the exact same problem on the left. It's just been, I think, better managed. And I think there's some more rational actors on the left than there are on the right. And you start to think about Boebert and Gossard and some of the really wackies. Yeah. They're really, really wacky.
Bob Griffin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, June 14th. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, or facts may have changed or evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, June 15th, Joe Donahue was joined in studio by Tetherless World Chair of Computer Web and Cognitive Sciences and Founding Director of the Computing Institute at RPI, Jim Hendler, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and Wall Street Investment Banker, Mark Whitman.
All right, so let's go to the AI story for the day, and Jim, we'll give this one to you because you're the only one who understands it.
No, this is actually an interesting one in that the European Parliament moves on things a little bit differently than we do, and you know it's a consensus-building entity, but the main thing is that they have voted to take up AI regulation in such a way that there will be a law passed by within the next couple of years. And it's really, you know, fascinating. Now, full disclosure, I work for a non-lobbying entity. It's the largest professional community organization for computer scientists. It's called the Association for Computing Machinery. And I chair the global technology policy, which has put some input into this. But the thing that's really nice about it is they realized this could not be a monolithic law, that you couldn't just say, yes, you can use it, no, you can't. So what they did is they've created a set of categories, right? This stuff we don't really care about. It's not going to hurt anyone. This stuff we want to be careful about because it could, you know, affect human rights and civil rights. This one we really want to be careful about because we're talking about things that can kill people. And they actually had four levels. I won't go into the details. But so they're going to negotiate through that, how it's going to work through, how it's going to be done is hard to say. But, you know, in the U.S., we tend to have a regulatory system that limits our government but gives tremendous freedom to companies, right? In China, it's just the opposite. So China recently passed some AI regulations, which basically says companies can't keep much of their information. They have to give it to the government and not share it. Europe comes in somewhere in the middle and really says we have to balance the rights of governments to protect people versus people's, you know, ability, you know, the capitalist ability. We do want to have big companies here, but we don't want to see these mega corporations able to control everything. They've just taken another big step against Google and things like that. So in the AI regulations, they've been unquestionably the leaders, and their primary emphasis previously has been on privacy. When you use these AI systems, you're sharing information with a company, which then has the right to share it with anyone they want except the U.S. government, and that requires a subpoena. And some of what's out there is stunning. Fran and I have often talked about this, but I teach a course on just how much data is out there about you and who's collecting it and what they're doing it and who they're selling it to. And you know, even my graduate students in computer science are stunned when they learn what the reality is. Europe had the best laws. They just were not – it's just hard to – internationally enforce something that's only passed by part of the world. These AI laws, what I think the impact will be when they finally pass. So if you look at GDPR, you go to a lot of websites now and it says, you know, here's our cookies policy. Most people ignore that. But in fact, that's important. And that's because they don't want to have one version in the U.S. and a different version in Europe and a different version somewhere else. And these AI laws are going to do that same thing. So they're going to have to be much more careful. Some of these big companies are going to have to figure out, you know, how they want to deal with government and government regulations in Europe and how that's going to impact U.S. In the U.S., we have a lot going on in this. Senator Schumer has recently been meeting with a lot of people from the corporate sector. He's meeting with my group. His staff is meeting with my group this afternoon. We have some other people. You know, he's met with, I think there was a group of 20 or 30, actually it was about 50 Congress people from, and a good mix of the parties. So people are really.
I was hoping he was meeting with 50 Cent.
Regarding AI.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. So, you know, again, the good news is we're starting to see people who realize that this very, very powerful and useful technology, right, if unregulated, is going to belong to a few very large companies because it costs $100 million to do one training run of these things. ChatGPT does hundreds and hundreds of training runs before it releases something. I mean, so we're talking about things that really only the biggest entities with the most money can possibly do, and that means it's government and industry. And Europe is trying to find that balance, so it's really fascinating.
It is fascinating, and that was a great explanation. There's one part of the article, though, and you may have addressed it, and I just missed how it applies here. But in the first paragraph of the article, it talks about how this is going to lap the United States and be on a collision course with the U.S. So what does that collision course look like? Because I didn't read that as a good thing.
So, again, let's use an analogy that goes back a few years. Europe passed a set of privacy laws that were very different than the U.S. privacy laws. So you could say that's that clash. Right. The good news for us as U.S. citizens is these multinational companies are now complying with that law, at least to some degree in the U.S., just because they don't want to have to build everything twice and things like that. Right. The clash here is that the U.S. is moving to regulate really impact, who can use it, how they can do it, how to, you know, again, it's really interesting. The CEO of OpenAI, the company that released ChatGPT and has caused a lot of this madness about how AI is going to kill us all by the, you know, 10 years from now, apparently only 40% of CEOs believe that AI will kill us all by 2033. you know, he came to the U.S. and said, I want to be regulated. And then the minute Europe started talking about this regulation, he's published, I'm seriously opposed to how Europe is regulating AI, right? The U.S. companies want to write the rules. Europe has a very different model, which says government's job is to protect the people. Right. And, you know, I mean, theoretically, that should be true everywhere. China is really into authoritarian control and is using AI centrally. U.S., again, is into capitalism and says, look, we have these mega companies that wouldn't be here in the U.S. if it hadn't been for our open regulation. And Europe is saying, let's find the balance. So it definitely is a clash. It's just a, you know, it's not sort of like this head-to-head, we want to do it this way and you want to do it that way. It's that the U.S. is way behind. We're lagging on this stuff. And Europe has kind of, I think, woken us up to the fact that we'd better start thinking about what laws we want to pass in this space.
I have a question, Jim, which is the article I read, and there's a good one in The Economist about this that summarizes the various approaches, says that the EU is protecting against breaches in privacy, bias, and they're also trying to protect intellectual property. I've also heard that AI is going to kill us all. You've dismissed that. Is there anything between the three that the EU is protecting against and kill us all that we should also be worried about? I'm always mystified by what the real risk is here.
So a lot of people are, including all of us who do this stuff. So think about it this way, right? You have a tool, right? Here's a hammer, right? Hammers can be used for good things and hammers can be used for bad things, but the damage that the hammer can do is pretty limited, and so it's pretty easy to say, you know, our current laws on who's allowed to hit who with what cover hammers.
Yeah.
Okay. Now take a machine gun, not an AR-15 because I don't want to get political, but let's take a real machine gun, right? Right now you have to be in the U.S. military and approved, and you sell one of those to someone outside the military within the U.S., you're breaking a law.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a tool that can be used theoretically, quote, constructively in warfare, assuming you assume warfare is ever constructive, but you're limiting its use. And then, you know, you can move up to nuclear bombs. So the real question is, where is AI on that statement? And what a lot of us believe is it's moved some sort of from hammer to chainsaw.
Okay.
So with a chainsaw, A, you can hurt yourself a lot if you don't know what you're doing. B, you can hurt other people. But by and large, it can also be used for a lot of very important things that you can't do without a chainsaw.
Yeah.
The question is, do we let it move to machine gun where you stop seeing some of those positive uses? And some of these people are saying it's more like a nuclear bomb.
But what's the machine gun threat from...
I was going to say, we're doing Vox Pop on AI on January 20th.
But in 20 seconds, give me the machine gun threat that I should start thinking about.
Yeah. Basically, it's if we allow autonomy to these systems, if we allow these systems to make decisions that currently have a human in the loop, right? And we do it inappropriately or wrongly. So what most people are worried about is misuse of these. So I'll give you a simpler one, right? Misinformation. It's now that video of the Pentagon bombing that was fake, right? And there's a question, was that done for stock manipulation? Was that, but broke no laws in the U.S. In Europe, it would have broken a law, okay? But we just heard, you know, that the Beatles, a new Beatles song is coming out because they've been able to use AI to recreate it, right? How it should really have sounded and the four voices. And so, you know, there's something where the same exact thing has been, in one case it was used.
So there's blasphemy.
That's what I'm saying. So in one case it was used in a fake way, in another, you know, badly. In another way, it was used in a, quote, fake way, unquote, potentially positively. And the question is, how do we as society deal with something that's that fast moving and where we really don't, most people don't understand when you're using the systems, what you're sharing and what you're doing.
And because we don't understand, I'm very, very glad that you are working on this because you do understand. So thank you very much.
And just because Ray would be very unhappy if I didn't mention it, yes. June 20th, Vox Pop is an AI set.
Jim Hendler on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, June 15th. We'll be back with the final segment of this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, June 16th, Joe Donahue was joined by Artistic Director and CEO of Berkshire Theatre Group, Kate McGuire, President and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, and Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti.
Aaron, let's start with you, because I think this is interesting about the Fed rates. We didn't know what was going to happen, and, well, maybe you did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Sorry.
Sorry.
That's why he's here.
I did not mean for that to come out the way it did. I apologize.
Fed leaves rates steady but forecasts more moves. Central bankers have raised rates at the fastest pace since the 1980s, but now they're taking time to survey how the changes are working. And I guess the part of the story that that I found somewhat surprising is I guess I didn't expect rates to go anywhere this time. However, I did that idea of this is always going to be somewhat precarious was the element that I think I didn't expect.
Yeah. So, you know, for the first time since March of 2022, the Fed has stopped, you know, paused their rate increases. It's been 10 straight rate increases from 0% all the way up to 5%. And they've been doing that to intentionally slow the economy down. We've had inflation that's resulted from COVID supply chain bottlenecks. We've had inflation that's resulted from Putin's invasion of Ukraine. So there has it's been a very anomalous 3 years. And the big problem that resulted from that was rising inflation. So the Fed's trying to cool down the economy and get inflation under control. And what a lot of economists have been saying, and it's why I made that snarky comment of like, well, I did at the beginning, is that many economists thought that the Fed was being overly aggressive in how they were dealing with inflation, is that they're going to create a lot of unnecessary unemployment. They're going to create a lot of unnecessary layoffs. They're going to create a lot of unnecessary contraction in the economy because they're, you know, being too aggressive with inflation. So we saw that with the banking crisis that unfolded in March and remained contained, largely due to the intervention from the FDIC and the Fed. But this, you know, the Fed's decision to pause rate increases, but they also telegraphed, we're going to raise interest rates by another half a percentage point over the next year. That came on the heels of Tuesday's inflation report, which was surprisingly low. So inflation, the cost of living, the average, you know, increase in the prices of the goods and services we buy, peaked at 9% last summer. And now it's down to 4%. So the Fed has seen a meaningful decrease in inflation. And I think that's giving them some cause to say, let's see what the last 10 rate increases have done, because there's always a lag. When the Fed raises interest rates, it can take 6 to 12 months before that's felt in commercial lending markets and consumer lending markets. So the Fed's, you know, there's all of this backlog of rate increases, and it's going to hit very likely like a tidal wave at some point. So the Fed wants to make sure they're not overshooting. But the inflation report was really good. It's really a story of rising food prices and shelter prices. So, you know, food prices are up because of Putin's invasion of Ukraine and how that interrupted the international flow of grain that's used. Also, and I, you know, thank Judith Enk for always pointing this out, you know, this this low-grade effect of climate change, which is turning from low-grade to medium-grade, the droughts, the extreme weather creates a lot of uncertainty and shortages in food production domestically and internationally. So, in my opinion, the Fed's overshooting. They've gone too far, and they really need to just stop and wait to see how things play out, because if they don't and they continue with their planned rate increases, it's going, again, it's going to cause a lot of unnecessary layoffs, a lot of slowing growth. It's going to raise the cost of borrowing money to buy a home, borrowing money to buy a car, borrowing money to do anything. Those costs go up. So, you know, the Fed's trying to, you know, depress wages, depress growth, and they're trying to kind of restore the normal order where, you know, wage growth is low, so workers don't have a lot of bargaining power, and that, you know, shifted back to it at an era where businesses have, you know, far more power over, you know, the economy and their workers. So, you know, they're overshooting. They should consider that pause to go on for an extended period of time instead of transmitting the fact that they're going to raise rates more.
When do you see problems starting to arise?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I would think that, you know, based on when the Fed started, how aggressive they've been, you're probably going to see the negative effects of that. Increased unemployment, rising layoffs, less borrowing in late 23, early 24. So probably not for a while, but it will happen, and it probably will be more severe than a lot of economists are expecting.
As an administrator and artistic director, but of the in the arts, it's been my understanding that sort of Main Street and the arts sort of feel the impact first of
Every time something happens in the economy, whether it's, you know, everyone is talking about inflation or the stock market is shifting, giving slows way down.
Yeah.
We're not seeing, our houses have been really full, so we're seeing good ticket sales, but contributions are always impacted, just because people get scared about what's to come. And artists kind of thrive in chaos, but the arts themselves, the organizations, don't. It's an interesting.
That's really interesting. So, meaning that the artist, the idea of the arts, it can.
Well, we stand in the middle of chaos all the time in the arts, right?
Right.
And it is the artist that observes around them what's going on.
The chaos is their muse.
For some, and what we're always doing on a stage, whether it's music or dance or whatever, is trying to show what it means to be human. So if there's a lot going on, there's a lot of energy out there, and there's a lot driving the artist.
And then can you say to the audience, you see that? That's what we're trying to avoid. Can you give us money?
Well, of course we say that. I say it all, just like you do.
Like every night,
right?
I say
it all the time.
Yeah.
And it is that we are also, our organization is a not-for-profit. I truly mean a not-for-profit.
Right.
Which is an interesting or kind of organization to be in a capitalist society.
And one more thing that I'm fascinated by, because it also, and this is with the colonial, I guess you see this at Stockbridge too, but with the colonial right in Pittsfield, the city feels it too, right?
Of course the city feels it. I mean, Stockbridge at this particular time, I think, continues to thrive. There are a lot of second homeowners in Stockbridge, so it's a very different community than Pittsfield. We feel really fortunate, though, Joe. Our numbers, people are coming out again. And maybe it's because they were locked up during COVID, but people are coming to the theater. People are coming to the Colonial. My goodness, how many were there when you were there for David Sedaris?
Yeah.
Over 700 people.
Yeah.
And the night before we had a comedian, it was the same number. So our numbers in terms of people in the seats, we're doing well. It's just, it really is the contributed side. And foundations start to go down. Mm-hmm. And so at a time of chaos, when people need the arts more than ever, we struggle harder. But like everyone else, I think, right?
Sure. Yeah, no. It's just an interesting perspective, because that's not something that, you know, we normally talk about when we're talking about the Fed. There's, you know, talk about the banking sector, but never the art sector.
Yeah. And it is nice. Also true that we have never been treated so well by the government as we were over the past 3 years.
Meaning the help that they gave you during COVID.
Yes. They sustained the arts in this country.
So, and then what was it like to lose that then?
It's not good.
So you're doing well, and then it stops.
The faucet shut off.
Yeah. And you know it's going to shut off. But,
we do know it's going to shut off.
But you're still, it's hard to fully wrap her.
That's one of the reasons that we keep saying the faucet is going to shut off. We hope that you'll remember that your ticket takes care of 50% of what we do, and the other 50%, we need your donations.
Beg, borrow, and steal. Well, not steal.
I was going to say, I think beg and borrow.
Yeah, I didn't.
Beg, borrow.
Yeah.
We don't steal. We'd get caught before anyone.
Heather, anything you would like to say about the Fed rates and the general state of the economy?
I feel as though it's always wise to agree with Aaron. I think last time I disagreed with him on something and I said, I'm no economist, and some listener immediately called me out and said, I should not speak to things upon which I am not an expert.
But, you know, I got so many positive comments about our back and forth. I think we were talking about the minimum wage.
Yeah.
So lay into me.
Yeah. No. I think you're right.
Bring it on.
I actually do agree with you. I think that it's a lagging indicator, and I think that, you know, the impact of the rate increases we're going to feel at some point. We're not getting the full effect of them. I think that this is a weird environment, though, because the labor participation rate is so low right now that even with layoffs, and we saw in the tech sector, there's not a huge impact on unemployment. So some of the indicators that they've reached their limit might not actually be coming into effect.
Right.
And I mean, my employers will tell you, like, we are in a very big workforce problem. Mm-hmm. I had a debate a number of years ago with someone who's now a member of Congress when he was in the assembly, who he was really worried about what was going to happen with automation. And, you know, we didn't talk specifically about AI, but basically technology replacing people in terms of workforce. And my comment back to him was, we have a demographic issue. We're not going to be able to maintain GDP with the population that we have. And now it's even worse because of what happened with immigration during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people left the workforce and didn't come back. There's still about 1.5 million people missing from the workforce. Mm-hmm. So if we want to keep our GDP robust, and New York actually has very high GDP per capita, mainly because of the financial services industry, we need people in the workforce, and we need to automate, and we need AI. We need all of those things. I am concerned that the other impacts of inflation, of rate increases, are going to really be damaging, especially in borrowing and lending. Lending, I guess, is
there's really... I've been debating whether or not to say this, because it's kind of technical and nerdy, but it's really important. Is that the way the Bureau of Labor Statistics calculates the inflation rate? 40% of that is housing costs, but the way they measure housing costs looks at leases that were signed over the past year. So when they released the inflation report on Tuesday, that was looking at rent increases that happened in the summer of 2022.
Mm.
Now, that was the peak of the housing price increase. That was the peak of the rental increase. If you look at more current data on that, produced by Zillow and, you know, other, you know, realtor sites, those are now negative. Like, rents have come down since then substantially and are actually decreasing in price. So real inflation is probably closer to 2+% instead of 4%, because what the Bureau of Labor Statistics measure is picking up is the rapid appreciation in housing and rent prices last summer. So they've already come down, but right. that's not being included in it. So that's why I said that I really think the Fed is overshooting, and they would be wise to just say, we're just going to not hit the gas nor tap the brakes for an extended period of time until we see this play out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had a meeting last week in Buffalo and met with a real estate developer who was expressing his frustration at the fact that, you know, he has built a number of residential developments as part of whatever local incentive package. And, you know, this is how it works. A number of the units that he builds are low income, mm-hmm. Affordable housing units. Well, he wants to expand. He wants to build more affordable housing, and he can't get a loan because during the pandemic he couldn't evict anyone.
Sure.
A lot of people didn't pay their rent. He has no ability to recover that. So on the books, the math doesn't work, and the interest rates are higher. So the banks are saying, "Hey, you know, this is not sustainable. Mm-hmm. We're not going to lend you money to build more affordable housing because you're not generating enough income off of what you've got already, you know, to service the debt." Well, this is a problem, right? And at the same time, we have our legislature talking about further restricting the ability to basically remove tenants who are not paying the rent. So that's going to compound the problem as we head down the road, especially if the interest rates for borrowing are as high as they are, because you need more money to pay mm-hmm. them back.
Mm-hmm. Right? It's a huge problem in Berkshire County, too.
Yep.
I mean, nobody can find enough labor. And housing, when we hire people to come, and a lot of times we'll get college grads that are just starting their first job, and so they're moving to the Berkshires, and they can't find anything affordable. And it's exactly what you were just saying, Heather. The contractors and the developers in the area can't make the numbers work, and it just keeps spiraling.
Yeah, and the more we tilt the table away from allowing the people to recoup their investment in the property, the fewer units get built. So it actually, policies that are intended to protect people compounds the problem and makes real estate more expensive. I mean, New York City is a very sort of distinct example of that. And there's a lot of other problems there. I mean, I think people forget sometimes, like with Manhattan, it is an island, and island real estate is always more expensive because you don't have the room. You have to build up, you know, mm-hmm. Which is more expensive. I think we're going to be talking a lot more about housing costs. And I also think there was another cost pressure on the cost of building new housing because of supply chain issues during the pandemic.
Sure.
And that's, you know, slowly recovering. But, you know, just the cost all the way around went up. And
this is going to take years to work out of the system.
Yep.
And I think the Fed's trying to squeeze it all out in, you know, 12 months. And I think some of this will get worked out naturally.
Yeah.
Some of it will be a lingering issue. And I think the Fed's trying to accelerate that. But I think the bigger risk is that they're going to overshoot and create a lot of unnecessary unemployment and, in, you know, the worst case scenario, a recession.
Let's go to some letters from our listeners. Valerie writes, when and how, Aaron, did 2% become the magic number for an agreeable inflation rate?
Well, economists are still wondering that. I don't know specifically when, but it was, I believe, in the 2000s, right around Ben Bernanke's chairship. 2%, you know, there's no magic. 2% is not a magic number. Why isn't it 3%? Why isn't it 4%? Why isn't it 1%? And the reason is that it's 2% because you need a little bit. The Fed needs a little bit of wiggle room. If you shoot for 0% inflation and you overshoot, then you create long periods of exceptionally slow growth. If you let inflation run above 0% at like 2% and overshoot, the damage is minimized. But a lot of economists are calling for an inflation target of like 3 or 4% because it can allow for faster wage growth, it allows for increased economic activity, and it moves the Fed out of a corner. Right, where they don't feel the need to just, you know, be hawkish all the time like they're doing now. So it's arbitrary. There's nothing magic about 2%. That's just where the Fed landed about 20 years ago.
But they can't change it while they're taking corrective action, right? I mean, I think it would undermine the credibility.
So Jerome Powell, yeah, no, you're right. In 2020, he announced that the 2% is not a ceiling, it's an average. So if you run below the 2% average for a period of time, then you should compensate by running above the 2% average. So over a decade, it averages out.
Right.
But in this environment, no, the Fed can't change course and be like, oh, by the way, we're going to go for
3%. We decided 4% was
That's better. That's a better decision to make during calmer, less turbulent times.
Yeah.
Joe writes to us and says, in our personal experience, giving has had less of an effect on our taxes over the last couple years. My understanding is that the Trump tax cuts made it so that for middle class families, middle income families like ours, charitable giving now has to hit a higher level in order to count towards our deduction. We don't give just to get, but the tax break did allow us to give more in years past. I wonder if others have had the experience and what impact on the nonprofit arts sector has been. My thanks to all in the arts and nonprofit media world. Your work makes us better as a country and a culture.
Yes, another impact that, you know, we receive negatively, for sure, that people aren't getting the same benefit at a certain level of income. You can't take that benefit. And in addition to that, for the artists themselves who used to be able to take tax breaks for classes and, you know, their hair appointments because they had to go to a certain function or they had to go to an audition, whatever it was, books, movies that they have to do for the sake of their craft, all of those deductions are gone. So that affects, you know, those changes
the bottom line, sure.
Mr. Trump made really impacted us.
Tom writes, don't forget to add corporate bloat to the causes of inflation.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's, thank you, Tom. There's been a lot of...
Aaron, rule of thumb, never pass up the chance to say corporate bloat.
Yeah, no, I know. It's, how about this one? So the Biden administration has been talking about a lot of sludge in the system, which is... these fees that just come out of nowhere when you buy a good, like concert tickets is the obvious example, right? You buy, you go to the Ticketmaster website to go see Noel Gallagher at SPAC and it's, oh, $40. And then you get to the final page and it's like, oh, no, it's $75 because there's $35 of service fees and handling fees. So that's...
I've heard those described as hidden fees. I've heard them described as garbage fees.
Who's opening for Noel Gallagher, incidentally? Garbage.
Garbage. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Sorry.
Nice. I just want to say, if we're going to go down this road, then government shouldn't be allowed to do it either. I mean, on your utility bill, more than half of that are taxes and fees that have nothing to do with the service that's being provided. And they're not allowed to tell you because that's what the rules are. The rules say they're not allowed to say, well, this is the 18A surcharge that's being used to fund the regulator. This is the blah, blah, blah. And same with health insurance.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah, this is the point.
You know, it's all a bunch of crap. But if government is going to say you private sector can't add a handling fee and can't, well, they shouldn't be able to do it either.
But it's not the government that's adding the fee.
No, it is.
No, it's National Grid.
Well, no, it's not, and that's where you misunderstand. It's not National Grid that's adding the fee. It is the government. They are mandated to collect money that they then hold. It's a regulatory asset that they then hold and they turn over to the government that gets used to fund other things, not them.
Okay.
It's the same. And the same is true in health insurance.
Heather Mulligan on the Roundtable panel on Friday, June 16th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. You can find us on Twitter as @WAMCRoundtable or @WAMCRadio. We're on Facebook and Instagram as @WAMCRadio. Once again, our website is WAMC.org. This has been the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.